This is K. Scott Allen of odeco.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code. This is being recorded on June 9th, 2009. Tonight's guest is Damian Gard. He's been developing software since 1983, where he learned to program on the Acorn BBC Micro by day and the Sinclair ZX Spectrum by night. Currently, he is a software development engineer at Microsoft on the data programmability team. So he works quite a bit with Link2SQL and also some with the Entity Framework. So good evening.
Good evening.
Well, one reason we wanted to have you on was to talk about Link2SQL. It's been a bit of mystery to people outside of Microsoft what's been happening with that technology. A lot of people assumed that it was going away or that it was dead or there wasn't going to actually have any more improvements, but it seems like you've been working on Link2SQL and rolling out some great stuff for it. So what's the story there?
So last year, Tim Malu from our team actually put out some information about the primary focus of a data programmability team being Entity Framework. And I think there was a few people in the community who picked up on this and kind of read into that that Link2SQL was dead, and that really wasn't the case at all. So what we've been doing is, over the last year since SP1 was done, is focusing on some pain points and some bugs and customer feedback and addressing those where we can. I think the main thing with Link2SQL is we're not looking to go out in drastically new areas for features, but we're still intending on improving the core and making sure it carries on doing what it does today really well.
And also, sort of something I guess that was out of band for Link2SQL was some T4 templates that you put together.
The T4 templates are interesting. One of the main feedback we were getting both on the EF and L2S team is the concept of code generation. It's one of those things, some people love it, some people hate it, but even the people who love it don't always love the code that is generated. And with Link2SQL, SQL Metal and the Link2SQL designer don't give you really any flexibility beyond saying, hey, I want this pluralized. So what we did there is we spoke internally, and the plan for the Entity Framework was to switch to the T4 generation, which they're now shipping in VS 2010. Rather than wait for that to happen, I actually took the initiative and put together some code generation templates for Link2SQL. So they basically replaced the entire DBML to C# or VB.NET code generation. And the advantage with these templates is the fact that you can actually customize absolutely everything because they're very similar to ASP.NET files.
So these would be good to use in a situation where you are programming with a database schema first and you just want to code gen some classes from that?
Yeah, if you've got a DBML file, I mean, that's basically the input to them. So you can, drag your tables off into the designer, switch off the existing code gen, drop the templates in, and then really start customizing them. But you can do all sorts of things with these. You could make it generate a XML mapping file and POCO objects if you wanted to go down the POCO route on Link2SQL. You could generate a repository interface if you wanted to go down that route. It's just basically a way of taking this DBML source and really deciding what interface you want to Link2SQL.
I forget, where are those available? Is that on your blog or is that on CodePlex now?
They were originally on my blog, but they're now up on CodePlex on l2st4.codeplex.com, and they're under the Microsoft public license.
So when you're creating those, had you done T4 templates before? Did you find them pretty easy to set up?
I hadn't actually used T4. It's one of those things that until a while ago, not many people were aware of it. I'd actually done... before I joined Microsoft, I'd actually done the start of a T4 style template, but in a product called Codesmith, which I think probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with, which was great. And the plan was originally to really extend that out. And then internally, somebody pointed me to this little nugget called T4, which I was shocked that was hidden away in the product. And I badgered for Rob Connery and Scott Hanselman for a while to actually do some coverage. And thankfully, it's got some of the attention it deserves.
And so the T4 templates that are available for the Entity Framework, were they sort of based on your work or was that independent?
The original version of that was done by Danny Simmons independently, but as they started going along, they found there was a few areas where they really needed to do something very similar. So, for example, one of the things you can't normally do in T4 is produce multiple outputs from the same file. So what I did in the L2S templates was produce this manager class that lets you mark the beginning and ending of potential separate files. And then what you can actually specify then is there's an option there you can specify to true, and the manager will then split out all these files independently and add them to Visual Studio for you. So that was quite useful, and they reused that on the Entity Framework. I think a lot of the rest of it was kind of just about internally how we structure the balance between how much housekeeping code you have in the template where it's clearly visible what's going on and how much is pushed away into a helper class.
Excellent. Now, I understand you also did some work on the Entity Framework, mostly to move some Link to SQL features into that product.
Yeah, one of the things about Entity Framework in 3.5 SP1 was the fact that it didn't support a few of the link operators. So single or default, contains, default if empty. So I got the opportunity there to help them fill in some of the gaps. So now you can do things like generate in clauses and do left outer joins using these operators. Another person on the Link to SQL team was responsible for a new thing they have called object set. An object set is similar to table in Link to SQL, and it's now their top level exposure of the entity set on the actual context object. So you can now actually do things like context.customers.insert on submit style functionality instead of using, you know, add object and delete object straight on the context.
That's good. And Link to SQL, I think I read somewhere recently that Link to SQL actually has an iTable abstraction now.
It has a subset of the table. Yeah, one of the problems I think people have found trying to mock L2S was the fact that we have this table of T class, and although it has an interface, it has this iTable class, which is non-generic. So we looked at whether or not we should actually implement an iTable of T. There's a little bit of debate as to whether or not it should be the full iTable with all the various members of that actually has, or whether or not it should simply be an insert and delete. We went down the simpler route, mainly because if people are going to want to mock these things, they shouldn't really have to worry about all these extra members that aren't going to be necessary. But as always, if people are using this in beta 1 and they find it's not what they like, they should definitely send us some feedback.
So with the link extensions that you've done on EF, would you say that EF is sort of has link parity with Link to SQL now?
Yeah, I think all the operators are now fully supported in EF, as far as I'm aware. I mean, there still may be some discrepancies between the two. Null handling, for example, was always one where everyone has a different opinion on what behavior they want. So there's a few odd things like Link to SQL, if it finds contains, will in fact ignore nulls in contains, whereas we didn't really feel that was the right thing to do on EF. But apart from some of these little subtle issues, the bulk of it should be there.
Well, one thing that I saw looking over the list here is about skip zero no longer being a no op and changes for skip zero. What's the use case? Why would people be using skip zero to start with?
Well, obviously you'd never actually write skip zero. The real issue there is the fact that you'll probably find that skip zero is actually being put into your queries if you're doing paging, mainly because it will generate skip n, where n starts off as zero. It was an interesting one because I have a kind of slightly different philosophy to breaking changes than some people. And it was a difficult one to kind of take. We had a lot of issues that the skip zero no op path was causing issues with eager loading and some other difficulties. So what we did there is basically decided that in that case, breaking on the first page of results because the query is invalid is much better than having customers ship an application and find out that as soon as the customer hits next, their query was invalid.
One other thing here is I noticed at the top of the list, you've got some things about performance. And you're saying that a lot of this is customer-driven, the feedback. And I'm just wondering, like, I know probably one of the more high-profile sites I know of that uses Link to SQL is Stack Overflow. I don't know if you've got some other, high traffic or high volume or whatever users, and if you got some feedback from them that helped lead to performance, improvements?
Stuff like the text lengths is something that was purely customer driven. Internal and external customer driven. We saw that from a number of avenues. Unfortunately, I've not been able to get any feedback from the guys at Stack Overflow. It'd certainly be interesting to know exactly how they're using L2S and how they're avoiding that particular issue. And it's interesting because it's one of those bugs that actually comes up on both stacks.
It always seemed to me, in working with Link2SQL and the Entity Framework, that the SQL generation by Link2SQL is pretty good. It was pretty tight.
So, I mean, the advantage of Link2SQL is basically once it's taken the expression from that the compiler's generated, it's basically just completely optimizing that for SQL Server. And so, of course, it can really take advantage of understanding of SQL and the expression and really produce very, very nice optimal queries. Sometimes it gets them a little wrong, but generally it comes up with these great TSQL. In fact, we've seen a number of times where people have come back and said this SQL isn't actually as optimal as we thought it would be because, you know, we want this particular SQL statement. And in fact, you run them through the profile and you often find out that the one that Link2SQL generate, in fact, actually outperforms what you thought would be a good query. So it's great in that respect. The EF has a slightly different approach it has to take because it has a provider model, does a lot more processing before it hits these providers. I mean, it's a lot easier to write a provider for EF than it would be to write a raw link provider. So it kind of does a lot of work for you, but then, you know, a lot of these optimizations are really pushed down right to the end of the pipeline when you need to generate the TSQL, and all the information you need isn't necessarily available at that point unless you're prepared to do a lot of hard work. But the EF team have done a lot of hard work on V4 around optimizing these queries. I did a tiny little bit of work with this in stuff and optimizing ors to in, but they've also done a lot of work on reducing nulls, reducing joins, duplicate unnecessary column removal, these sort of things.
Interesting. I know like the ASP.NET team, they'll have these app building periods where they just go off and try to build some things with the framework that they're putting together. Is that something you do in the data programmability team too?
It is actually. We've actually got App Week on the 22nd of this month. So we'll all be building applications that use Entity Framework, finding out what it's like to be back on the other side of the fence for a week. I'm not quite sure exactly how this works because this is my first App Week, but it'll certainly be quite interesting. That one's going to sound like it was so set up.
Yeah, that's funny. I thought every product team did this, but I wasn't sure. What about things like test suites? Again, I'm like comparing it to what I know about the ASP.NET team, where they just have servers running all the time to see if they can break stuff on 8 cores and 16 cores and just doing bazillions of requests every hour. Do you guys stress this stuff out?
I'm not too familiar with the actual test infrastructure, but I know we have quite a comprehensive set of unit tests that we run before we can consider anything for code review or check-in. And then we have these overnight runs that run larger sets of tests. And then, yeah, there are these giant tests that take days and days to run that just fire thousands and thousands and thousands of combinations of queries at the product. But I've tended to keep quite a distance from that. It's quite intimidating.
So something else you mentioned that really got everyone here perked up was you mentioned something that would be like a Fluent API.
Yeah, so one of the things I've been looking at coming from the L2S side, looking at EF, was what we could do to reduce the barrier of entry. There is quite a lot of learning curve, and I think it can be quite intimidating looking at the EDMX files and the designer. So one of the things we looked at was, and in fact started a project for, was something called Code Only. And the idea of Code Only is that you can just write a very lightweight object context, have your pure POCO classes, and just say using Code Only, figure it out. Just use conventions, just figure out some mapping, and then you have the option to then actually create a database or, you know, check if a database exists, kind of like Link2SQL, and it will just run with this. So this is what we're delivering in an out-of-band CTP release. I'm not sure what the exact date is on that, but I'm sure it'll be announced on the ADO.NET blog when once they've got a firm date for that. In the subsequent version, there'll be a more fluent API for doing things like changing the mapping information, describing, you know, lengths, types, extra types of associations and relationships and inheritance. But the V1 of the product will have, well, the V1 of the CTP will have register key, will have a lot of convention mapping.
So it sounds like this is basically analogous to the Fluent and Hibernate project on the Inhibernate side. So would that be accurate?
Some of the ideas, like with some of the mapping configuration API, it's kind of a similar goal. But I think we're doing a lot more on the convention side. I think Fluent and Hibernate, you have to specifically, I mean, I haven't looked at it too much, but I think you have to specifically define every sort of mapping and piece of information you want. Whereas the idea of this is it will just take all the properties and map them to the database out of the box, unless you want to actually step in and change the conventions.
Actually, Fluent and Hibernate does have both of those. So
okay, cool.
It does have, you know, it's what they call auto mapping and then convention based mapping and then okay. Full like configurable mapping. So yeah, it sounds pretty analogous, which is great. I've been using Fluent and Hibernate and I've found it to be fantastic. So I'm really psyched that something analogous would be on the EF side.
Yeah, one of the disadvantages of working at Microsoft is you don't get to look too closely at competitors' products.
I've never understood that.
Yeah, I don't know. Speak to the lawyers.
I would understand why you can't look at the code, but it would seem like feature-wise you'd be able to install and test and run them.
I would imagine it's probably around the patent ideas. I mean, potentially even using a particular API could have a patent around it, I guess. But we've done some nice things with the API. It's quite nice to use, and I think people will find it quite a nice way to get into EF without having to expend too much time on learning some of Entity Framework's specifics.
So would this mean like no EF designer required at all?
Absolutely. You just write an object context that has like three or four properties on it, and then just have your Poco classes and just make a couple of API calls to a context builder, and away you go.
Interesting. So people that are doing test-driven development obviously had a real problem with the Entity Framework and the fact that you had to have a database schema first before you could ever get started, and you had to have the EDMX file. So I guess what I'm hearing now is that you could be doing test-driven development, and you could use TDD to drive out the design for your entities, and then just through the process of adding some additional C# or Visual Basic code, I guess, you could have something that actually works with EF.
Yeah, I think you could really go down the TDD and DDD routes and just design these clean Poco classes. You don't have to actually use code, don't you? I mean, they've got good Poco support in EFV4. So what you could do is you could go down that route and then decide you want to use the designer to map, you know, to map those into the database, or you could use code only and say, hey, I'm not really that particularly interested in how the database looks. I just want it to be similar to my objects, which of course was always a strength on Link to SQL, that if you're happy for your objects and your database to look pretty similar, which they often are on these greenfield developments, then you can run that way.
Right. And then I've just always been kind of curious, does anyone inside of the data programmability team champion TDD? Do they ever like stick up for the TDD type developer?
We have a bunch of people who are very interested in TDD and York.NET, and in fact, a lot of guys interested in the domain-driven design angle as well. I've seen that book on a lot of people's desks. It's difficult to design a framework following that sort of thing because, of course, our domain is object relational mapping. So I think that's times when, you know, it's good for, you know, times like App Week when you can really sort of tackle it again from the app user's side or app developer side, and really get a handle on, okay, this isn't as great as the API I thought it was. This is one of the great things we've done on Code Only, is in fact we started with the API for the first several weeks on this project. We were just designing the API, just writing the sort of code that we think users would write to use the product, and just, you know, making it clearer and clearer and finding a really nice sweet spot, and then going away and figuring out how to achieve that, rather than, you know, as often is the case with large products, of designing this big architecture up front.
Right. But people that are outside of Microsoft but know a little bit about Microsoft kind of worry that the data programmability team is too close to the SQL Server team, and maybe that skews all the thinking towards the database. But
It's interesting you'd say. I mean, we are physically located in the same building as the SQL team, but I think I see just as much of the .NET team as the SQL team. And of course, it's actually very interesting that, I mean, originally Link to SQL came from, you know, one of the .NET teams. And it's quite interesting that they decided to expose foreign keys, which is really a database concern, not an object concern. And the Entity Framework team actually decided in V1 to not expose foreign keys, despite the fact they're coming from the database angle.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's interesting that each team decided to go down the other's route.
But that was actually, you know, some of my concern was that Link to SQL did come from basically people that are oriented towards objects in C#. And it just kind of seemed like if it was going to get sucked into the data programmability and be closer to SQL Server, that it might go more the Entity Framework route. But it sounds like you have something that's going to be pretty good for people that do TDD, make them happy.
Yeah, I think it's been a big focus. I mean, POCO and foreign keys have been some of the top tasks that people have been working on and really trying to get right.
You know, going back a ways, so there's code-only support for configuration of Entity Framework. Is that something that would be useful in Link to SQL, or is it addressing domain concerns that only really fit with Entity Framework?
I think it would actually be quite nice to get that into Link to SQL as well. The real issue there is, I guess, one of planning and time. Link to SQL actually has a metadata model, so you can in fact plug in your own mapping provider. So out the box, we ship one that reads from these .map XML files, and also the standard one that reads from attributes. But there's nothing stopping anyone from actually coming up with a project that actually gives you a Fluent-style API for configuring that and basing it on conventions. I guess I'm going to have to see what happens with code-only and how what route that takes and whether or not we could actually either do something similar in the box or whether or not we could actually get something up on CodePlex or CodeGallery that did something similar. I mean, it'd be obviously have to be a slightly different API because EF supports all sorts of extra mapping configurations, but certainly something I'd be interested in.
Back when people mistakenly thought that Link to SQL was just completely dead, I know some people were asking, you know, well, could it just be published on CodePlex? You know, could it just be opened up source code-wise? And I still think that question is interesting. I mean, I understand, you know, there are reasons not to give everything away, but like, for instance, with, you know, ASP.NET MVC being published on CodePlex, do you think that there's, I mean, obviously you can't answer if you can do it or can't, but would there be value in that, do you think?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I know that it's certainly not the first time I've heard this, and people internally and externally have spoken about that. I'm not really sure what you get much advantage in there. I mean, there are a lot of people who will only use what comes in the box. And so I think Link to SQL appeals to these people as it is. I think if it was to be brought out of the box, it wouldn't really have much of an advantage anymore over things like third-party solutions or nHibernate or some of these other technologies like...
Sure. Well, I mean, like as an example, I know Subsonic, they did a lot of work to support Link. And if, I mean, one of the advantages of Link to, or of Subsonic is the ability to plug into other databases. Whereas Link to SQL's, you know what I mean? Link to SQL is linked to SQL Server, you know? So,
there's of course the myth of the Link to SQL hidden provider internal model that's come up on a couple of blocks. Internally, it does have a provider model, but it's worth realizing that the Link to SQL source code, probably about 80% of the Link to SQL source code is the SQL provider. It does not really have much of a provider model. It basically just passes the expression tree to the Link to SQL provider. So the rest of the code will be for things like state management, the object, the data context. So I don't really think you'd get much out of that angle. The question is whether or not people would add extra features. But again, you know, you've got the issue then you'd have to get sign off, you'd have to ship it, you'd have to, I don't know. I think the sort of people who are attracted to Link to SQL are attracted to it for its simplicity and the fact it's in the box. I think if you take it out of the box, it loses a lot of that appeal against competitive products.
Right. Okay.
True. But that code that converts expression trees into Transact SQL would be really interesting.
Well, one of the original developers on Linked SQL is a guy called Matt Warren, who has been writing a series of blog posts about writing your own iQueryable provider. And he's actually now got to the stage where it's got its own little provider model, and it's running, you know, it's generating TSQL, and it's also now got a JET provider. And he's bundled the whole source code up on CodePlex. So if you're interested in how it works, it's certainly a very, very interesting
iQueryable provider toolkit, right?
Yeah, IQ Toolkit. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's also good, of course, because Matt's, as with any technology, every time you have another stab at it, you find out, you know, nicer ways of doing things. And the design in the IQ Toolkit is very nice if you want to learn how a provider's written by somebody who's probably done it more times than anyone else. That's actually up on CodePlex as an OSPL project.
I had one more question about the code only stuff. Does that support database schema generation after the fact? So, you know, you can just define your model in code and have it spit out the database schema on the other side?
Yeah, it can generate the full schema as it currently stands. You can actually script that out, or you can do a create database. You can also, you know, drop and delete like you can on Linked to SQL. The only thing it doesn't do is it doesn't handle versioning and trying to hold multiple versions of the schema and doing alters and stuff. There's a number of projects out there that handle that aspect, but that's not something we've been tackling on this project.
So you mentioned some of the work on Linked to SQL was in order to kind of get parity and make it easier to migrate to Entity Framework. And can you talk about like what problems did you solve there and what the experience is like moving from Linked to SQL to Entity Framework?
Over the course of a few months last year, actually some of the people on the L2S team actually investigated a lot of these areas, trying to figure out really where the disparity was and putting together some basic guidance. I think some of this was actually published up on the EF blog. Real issue we had there was the fact that obviously with 4.0 coming on the horizon, a lot of this wasn't really going to still be the case. So I think we still have a bit more work to do on working out now what the disparity between L2S and EF and V4 is, which is obviously a lot closer than it was in 3.5 SP1. But I think we probably need to get some more guidance out on this area.
Related to migration, you mean?
For those people who want to, you know, more advanced mapping scenarios, or, you know, want to use other backend providers.
So before we leave that topic, I guess the unofficial herding code guidance, what we could draw from this interview, is that if you're already using Linked to SQL and you're happy with it, it's perfectly fine sticking with that technology because it's being improved and it's still around.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we have people who, you know, who are primarily focused on this, you know, making sure it's behaving, improving. And I think the thing is, if you're waiting for a big, you know, massive feature like, you know, inheritance per concrete type or something, then you'll be probably better off looking at EF or another solution. But if it does what you like and what you need, then it's definitely still an option.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like the primary distinguishing factors between these two now would be things like table per type mapping, and also Entity Framework has other database providers at this time now.
Yeah, there's a number of third-party providers who are shipping for EF.
And if I understand the vision, it's also going to be something that you can use from reporting services and other products from Microsoft, whereas Linked to SQL will be mostly for the C# developer, maybe some ASP.NET controls, but it's mostly contained.
Yeah, I like to think it as EF Express.
That's good. EF Express. A product renaming in the future, perhaps?
I don't think I'd get away with that, but...
I was focused on Link for quite a while, and still am, and I see a lot of questions in forums and mailing lists and so forth. And you might need a minute to think about this, but is there any misconception or specific problem that sticks out as like the number one thing that people do wrong or that people don't know about in regards to Linked to SQL or Link in general? Or
I think one of the things that I see quite often on various lists is the problem people have when they do loops with regards to link queries, and often think they found a bug where they're saying, oh, it's only picking up the last instance of a loop variable, because it's very easy to forget you're actually constructing expressions here. You're not executing code. And so you're constructing all these expressions that are taking your loop variable, and when they're run later on, the loop variable only has the final value in it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. But I have seen that. That's a problem. Because the one I've often gotten involved with is when people just don't understand that the data context is a unit of work, or the object context is a unit of work, and it gets them into all sorts of trouble. So, you know, people that want to use one context for the life of an application, and you know, they don't understand why they're not seeing updates and so forth.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. Yeah, people trying to assign a data context to an application object in their web app and wondering why their memory usage after 12 hours has gone through the roof.
Can you talk a little bit about the work that's gone into supporting POCO in Entity Framework?
Yeah, so POCO supporting EF4 is something they focus quite a lot on. So out of the box, you can do a standard POCO. The difference there, of course, is you have to tell Entity Framework when to start looking at the objects and recording the various snapshots using the Detect Changes API. They've also got a couple of other options as well. If your object's purely got virtual properties, then they can actually create a proxy so they can do all the change tracking real time behind the scenes without you having to ever realize that it's actually another object. And they've also got something called iPoco, which is a less used scenario whereby you've done your POCO object, but you're quite happy to send iNotify style change notification to EF to let us know when your object's changed. Because at the end of the day, we have to keep some sort of state tracking to figure out what needs to go back to the database.
I have one more St. Leak the SQL question. I think I know the answer to this just based on your blog post, but I'll ask it anyways. One of the very first things that struck me when I first tried Leak the SQL was that there was no ability to resync the designer with changes in the database. Like, you generate your design surface, add some tables to the database, and there's no like refresh from the database. And coming from an analysis services world where that's built, that's built into the tool for analysis services, it was like a total shock to me. I didn't see that listed in your blog post, but I'll ask about it anyways.
Yeah, that's not currently in for 4.0. There's a couple of difficulties there. One is the fact because we allow you to customize these objects and rename them and stuff, the difficulty is really how we would know what the object looked like the last time we took it from the database. And so how we would know which things could be refreshed and which couldn't. It's certainly something that I'm sure a lot of people would like. The real question there is how it should be done and whether or not it could actually be fitted into the schedule.
Yeah, I'm guessing the answer there is, well, not the answer, but if you're using the T4 templates and you're already getting the code that you want from the DBML, it wouldn't be as much of a problem as it is now, where once you generate the DBML and go in and make a bunch of customizations, your only choice at that point is to,
is to basically throw away the DBML and bring out another one. In fact, we've seen some people doing this with, you can script the SQL metal command line as part of your build process to continuously bring the DBML out. And then, of course, you can use the T4 template to turn the DBML into exactly the code you want. The difficulty is really where you store these user customizations and how you deal with the fact that the user's customized something and how does that now apply to a refreshed model.
And K. Scott is a big fan of putting that in attributes. Just stack up the attributes and you're all set.
I must confess, what I tend to do is actually drag the table back out onto the L2S designer surface and then go edit the XML and just swap the elements around. It's not a great solution, but
I just want to point out that John Galloway does not represent the opinions of Cake Scott Allen.
Except when I'm editing the podcast later. Nah, that's kidding.
Yeah, my opinions are purely my own and not Microsoft's, that's for sure.
All right, so earlier this year, I had the, I think it was a pleasure, of giving you and Mr. Galloway a ride through downtown Seattle, and this discussion on fonts and typography, I guess, broke out. And this is an area where I don't even understand the domain language, but you guys, like, geeked out for 15 or 20 minutes on what fonts were best, and you know, the best fonts of 1995 and so forth. So my first question would be, since you're so heavily into this, you've designed your own fonts. What font do you use in Visual Studio?
I actually use my own font in Visual Studio, which is something called NV Code R, which a long time ago on some 8-bit computers, I started designing these fonts and kind of got a font I liked in a bitmap form, and it's kind of evolved with me over the years. And eventually some other people started asking for copies of it, having seen it on the screen. It's now turned into this TrueType font that's loaded with hints and has taken hundreds of hours. It's one of those things that if you knew how long it would take to ever start, you probably wouldn't have, started.
Yeah, because I don't know much about this domain. What did it take, for example, to make it a TrueType font? I mean, what's the difference between what you had before and a TrueType font?
The older fonts, the bitmap fonts or pixel fonts, it's basically, you know, like drawing in MS Paint. You just sort of sit there and turn pixels on and off. And the problem with this, of course, is you have to do it for every single size, which, you know, realistically, you're not going to do it for every single point size, so you would choose a few, which was fine. I mean, I have a specific preference. I like 10-point anyway. The real problem, I guess, once you go to ClearType is the fact that if you really want nice smooth curves and smooth edges, you can't do that with a bitmap font. They're purely mono. And so I purchased a font package called FontLab. And what FontLab lets you do is take in your bitmap fonts and trace them into vector outlines. So then they're much more like a, you know, SVG style and Adobe Illustrator with bezier curves and lines and points. The advantage of this, of course, is they scale, but the disadvantage is that small sizes, they scale quite badly because you get rounding issues and, you know, all of a sudden the midpoint on your E is not a straight line anymore and it doesn't line up properly with the top of your midpoint on your A, which is where the hinting comes in.
What gave you the inspiration to design your own font? I mean, I'm just trying to understand because for me, I look at something like Lucidia Console and I think, yeah, that's fine, that'll work. But obviously you had, you know, something that drove you into this. Was it just interest in fonts or did you actually see something that was defective in everything you tried?
It actually kind of goes back a little further than this. In the United Kingdom, we had a very popular home computer called the Sinclair ZX Spectrum, which I guess was probably the equivalent of your Commodore 64 in the US, which is just as popular. The built-in font for programming in BASIC was pretty horrendous. It was much worse than the fonts on the Commodore and on the Amstrad and on the Atari. But like the Atari, you could actually input a couple of pokes that would adjust the point in memory where it was getting the bitmap font from. And so a lot of font designing packages came out. I used to use something called Artist 2 that would just let you redraw the font, save it out as a file, and then later on you could load it back into memory, do a couple of pokes, and then you'd get your entire IDE equivalent back in those days, obviously just like a simple interpreter. And also when your program was running, would just all be rendered in this new font. So I kind of started designing all sorts of fonts. It was very popular on the Spectrum for people to design fonts. You know, you'd get futuristic fonts in certain games and scriptive fonts in various adventure games. So it was just kind of a thing that was done and kind of a need to have something that really wouldn't destroy my eyesight before I made it out of being a teenager.
Awesome.
So one of the things we talked about during that ride was I'd looked at an open source tool called FontForge, which, you know, is obviously cheaper because a real pro font package is expensive, right? I mean, you're talking, you know, Photoshop Plus in terms of price. But you were saying that really in order to do hinting, you need something like, what was the name of the tool you use?
I use FontLab, which is, I think it's about $500 or $600. Yeah, so you really have to really be interested. I mean, FontForge is a great package. It can actually do hinting. It's got an auto hinter in and you can actually edit the hints. The thing with hinting is it's like a stack-based assembler language. And so kind of everyone's come up with their own higher level language. So FontLab has a higher level language that lets you quite easily specify how stems and points relate to each other. That's kind of based on what Adobe did in their font format. Yeah, I think the one in FontForge takes a slightly different approach, but FontForge has the advantage you can actually edit the low-level assembler. There's also a package you can get from Microsoft if you're prepared to sign the license agreement, It's a free package called Visual TrueType. And this, again, has its own high-level language, a little bit different to the other two, but it lets you do stuff like strokes and diagonals, which was a real, in fact, still is an issue in the current version of MVCode R that's out there. It's very difficult to get like the diagonals on an M and an N to really kind of look the same sort of thickness as the verticals and horizontals.
You said as long as you're prepared to sign the license agreement, is there something onerous in that other than, you know, maybe, you know, I mean, why wouldn't you want to sign that license agreement?
Some people have an aversion to signing and faxing license agreements. I don't think there's anything nefarious in it. I signed it long before I joined Microsoft, but it's kind of hidden away on one of their typography pages. I hope the typography team doesn't get too many requests and start blaming me. It's quite nice to be able to go down there and get advice right now, but I'm not sure they'd be quite so helpful if I sent too many people their way.
Is your TrueType font, is that available for download?
Yeah, that's available from DamianG.com. The current version is 0.7. 0.8 has been in the wings for the last year, and I keep getting emails about releasing it. But it's interesting because with code, you kind of develop over several years the kind of feeling of when things are ready and you know, your own level of satisfaction with something that is well-tested and it's nicely designed. But I haven't reached this point with typography right yet. So I keep looking at it and thinking, this letter still needs improvement. This hinting still needs improvement. I still need these extra glyphs. So much harder to define a release point.
Now, I mean, what kind of, you want to release a new version, but I mean, what types of things are you looking at? Are you trying the font on different resolutions, different DPIs, different point sizes? Is that?
So there's a few things I'm looking at right now. One of them is, as you may have noticed, the Visual Studio 2010 Beta 1 has a slightly different way of rendering text that some people do and don't like. So one of the things I can do there is adjust the metrics to try and make MVCode R look a little nicer there. Some of the other things I've been doing is putting in like big Greek characters, which are actually quite hard to do. If you're not natively using these letters, it's very difficult to know which are the parts of the glyph you can actually really stylize to match the rest of your font and which you can't get away with. You know, with the Latin alphabet, we all know what makes up a letter A or a letter B, but it's a lot trickier if these glyphs aren't on something you're exposed to every day. So I've still got a little work to do on the Greek alphabet. And there's some other things to do with curves. Yeah, so some curves can be quite tricky to do and to get them to looking smooth and fluid all the way to the edge.
So one of the features that's cool about NVCode R is there's an NVCode R VS version that in the theme allows you to have your comments in italics. I forget the exact how you got that to work, but it was kind of a clever hack, I thought, when I read about it.
The IDE only, certainly in 2008, only supports bold and regular. And for a while I was wondering why it didn't support italic, and I tried a couple of things, you know, actually like specifying italic flags in the registry, and nothing was sticking. And I had the interesting idea of actually taking the italic font and actually marking the headers. So as far as Windows was concerned, it was the bold version. And it's just obviously not drawn in bold, it's drawn in italic. And that was enough to fool Visual Studio. In fact, I actually created, just for myself, a version of Consolus like this. This was before I joined Microsoft, and sent it to Brad Abrams to show him, look, VS is quite capable of drawing italics. Please switch this feature on. And I got back a very panicked email saying, please tell me you're not distributing this, which of course I wasn't.
Right.
But it was certainly something I could do in my own font.
Yeah. Yep, I'm happily using the humane theme that you've built. But I noticed in a recent screencast that you did when you were talking about the Link to SQL T4 templates that you were using a dark theme. And your humane theme is kind of interesting. It's one of the few that I've seen where you've got kind of like a tan background and some kind of it's very mid-tone. Are you still using a mid-tone theme?
Yeah, I'm kind of like a person who likes to change the color of their shirt three times a day, kind of in my themes and backgrounds. It's nice to have a refresh. My laptop tends to be stuck on the humane theme, but my work machine tends to jump between various color schemes. There's a guy called Thomas Restrepo who has a whole bunch of these various themes, and he's a regular user of MVCode R, so I quite like looking through his library of the various themes he's done and seeing them rendered already in the font I'm going to be using.
So I imagine that you know, being in Microsoft, you have access to lots of typography experts. Do you show them your font and say, hey, what do you guys think of this? And do they, you know, what kind of response do you get? Are they like, oh my God, what are you doing? Or are they, you know, oh, that's cute. That's how quaint. Or, you know, are they giving you advice on how to improve it? You know, what's their reaction?
Yeah, there's a few people over in the Microsoft typography team I've had the chance to meet. They recently had a mini type conference where various people interested in typography would get together and talk about various subjects. So I got to meet one of our hinting experts from Ireland where they do a lot of the user experience stuff and that sort of work. And he got me to really show how I should be really hinting this font directly in Visual Tree Type rather than doing it in FontLab so I could get these italic support. So that was very interesting. But I've also shown them NV Code R, and they've looked at it. They think it looks pretty good at 10. I have to admit, it doesn't look as great as Consolus once you start scaling this thing up. But I think the highest compliment was their hinting expert from Ireland looking at this font at 10 point, absolutely convinced it was not actually being rendered with clear type because it was so aligned to the grid, which of course was the trick from tracing it from a bitmap font in the first place. I think they did the same trick with the original version of Tahoma and Verdana as well, where they traced bitmaps to really, really get the font to look great at certain sizes.
In Windows 7, I've been reading about some of the new fonts that are in there. There's Gabriola, I think, and there's some others, and they take advantage of Direct2D and some other things that are way over my head. Have you looked at the fontography stuff or the typography or whatever it's called in Windows 7?
Yeah, I managed to get an early preview of Gabriella, which was very interesting to see. I think the technology they've added is called Direct Write, which is basically the typography equivalent of Direct2D and Direct3D. We finally get our own accelerated system. Some of the features in there look fantastic. I love the way that Gabriella goes from a very regular-looking font to something very ornate, depending on the settings you pass to it. Haven't looked too much about the API around Direct Write yet, but it's certainly something I'll be interested in doing.
That was my question when I started playing with it. I'd seen these really cool screenshots of it, and then I'm running Windows 7 and I've got the font. And I'm like, okay, how do I change, you know, how do I get it to switch into these ornate modes? And I guess that's something where the program needs to send API commands to do that, right? Because, I mean, there's no text setting that's, you know, bold, italic, ornate, you know. I mean,
yeah.
There's no way to switch that.
I think if you download the Windows 7 SDK, there's a bunch of Direct Write samples to actually show you how to enable these features. So it's definitely worth downloading and having a play if you're interested.
I have to ask this question as someone who, again, just hasn't focused on typography at all. Is there a popular font that you just despise? That when you see it on the screen, you just curl up?
Well, I could say the obvious one, but there's a couple of others as well. So avoiding Comic Sans for a moment, there's also a font called ERAS, which just grates on me every time I see it, and it has done since long before I was aware of a proper typography. It's quite recognizable because it's got a lowercase a that doesn't join up. It's quite unique in that none of the other letters have this characteristic, and it just sticks out. So that's quite an interesting one. The other logo I've recently been finding quite grating is the Bing logo. I'm not sure what's going on with the G at the end, but it doesn't look like it belongs with the rest of the letters.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at it now.
Yeah, but G tends to look like it was done by a different person.
Different. It's very subtle. It's one of those things you don't notice till you really start paying attention, I guess.
The other interesting one was one my friend of mine pointed out quite recently was for a HBO show called True Blood, and the typography looks like it was done by a small child.
Most people that don't know much about typography have just picked up from the movie Helvetica and some other things that you're pretty safe saying, you know, something about Helvetica. I mean, are you generally a fan of that or indifferent? Or
yeah, I love Helvetica. It's interesting that people claim they can't tell the difference between Helvetica and Arial, because it's one of those things, if you just glance at it and it looks right, it's probably Helvetica. If you just glance at it and you couldn't decide one way or another, it's probably Arial. I'm not sure my friends at Microsoft would appreciate me saying that, though, being that we ship Arial and not Helvetica, which, of course, is interesting given that the Microsoft logo is in Helvetica.
Oh, wow. That's the type of thing I never noticed.
Where do you land on the Microsoft-style font rendering versus the Mac, Apple-style?
I actually wrote a long article about this on my blog quite some time ago about how I generally preferred the Mac-style rendering. So for just like glancing at web pages and reading, I actually prefer the Mac-style rendering. But if I have to stare at something for several hours, like code, it's the Windows rendering. If I'm going to be staring at something for hours on end, it needs to be a lot sharper than the kind of the gentle Mac look. But for casual reading, yeah, the Mac wins. Probably not the clear-cut answer you were looking for.
that's totally fair.
Yeah.
I think it proves that, reading is a very personal experience. It's not just your preferences, it's also your environment, your lighting, and what you're doing. On the iPhone. The iPhone rendering looks great because of the high-res screen and stuff, but I've recently bought this thing called Classics, which got these classical books, and the font looks nice, but once you actually sort of sit there and are reading this book, some of them are like 700 pages, it starts feeling like it's not really in focus.
Do you have a Kindle?
I don't know. I've seen one down in Microsoft Typography. They've got a collection of various devices with alternate screen technologies. Because obviously the thing that's built into Windows 7 that does the rendering is taking advantage with ClearType of the sub-pixel alignment on screens. And that's obviously not, that doesn't even exist in devices like the Kindle or some of these other netbook style devices that using alternate screen technologies. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future and how they can take advantage of these devices to come up with nicer, crisper rendering.
Yeah, Kindle's interesting. I happened to win one in a raffle earlier, and I really do like it. It's not something I would have. I don't buy a lot of gadgets, but I really do like it, and I do notice that. I mean, like, I can't put my finger on exactly what, but my eyes do get tired from working on computers all day, and then I can go sit and look at a Kindle for a while, and there's no eye strain to it. I mean, it's very sharp. It's not, the resolution's low. There's this annoying flicker when you turn the pages and all that, but I mean, you can read it for hours it's like reading a book or whatever. So
yeah, I believe the technology they have there uses electrical charge to actually move these pigments, I think, from one side to another. It's basic, which is why, you get this slow refresh when you're turning the page, but it means it's got this extra, this extra level that you can't get on a traditional LCD, which are obviously, normally a certain amount of bits per subpixel.
So here's a question. How much does your choice of font, when you're working on something that you really have to focus on, like in an IDE or on the Kindle, how much does the choice of font play into eye strain and being able to look at this thing for hours on end?
I think it's very much a personal thing. There's the psychological thing, and there's also whether or not you can actually distinguish the characters. I think they've done a lot of research in these areas, various groups, about how quickly you can read text and what generally people prefer. But I think it's one of those things that it's difficult to measure because of everyone has a different perspective. And it's also, there's also the various other things, like how far back you sit from the screen, how bright your screen is, how bright your ambient light is. There's so many factors to bring in here. I think it's going to be one of these technologies. I think we're just going to see gradual improvements rather than any solid leaps.
Yeah, I was wondering with the Kindle, how much of a difference was the display technology versus, font choice and things like that.
Yeah, one thing that's nice, and I mean, this is, you're seeing this more and more programs, is that you can change the font size on anything. And another nice thing, just in terms of reading, is that there's generally no graphics involved. I mean, you can put graphics in, but most of the time, books on Kindle don't have graphics, and that ends up being simpler. Your eyes aren't jumping around or anything. It's just clean text, and so I think there's a lot of different factors in there, but I actually end up reading blog posts on there more. Like, I'm using it as my RSS aggregator and reading blog posts, and I can just kind of rip through them as opposed to...
Really? Compared to, like, Google Reader?
Yeah, I've never really gotten into Google Reader. I know that's heresy.
Yeah, I'm still a Google Reader fan.
Google Reader, actually, I had almost quit reading blogs for a while until I started using Google Reader. I was down to reading just literally a handful of blogs until I started using Google Reader.
I think there's a kind of a double-edged sword with stuff like Google Reader, though, because the original idea was to spend less time, you know, checking your favorite websites to see what's happened. And of course, the problem is you end up with checking five times as many sites now in Google Reader as you would have gone by hand.
Exactly. And then Twitter came along.
Right.
Right. And I became incapable of reading anything longer than 140 characters.
It's actually good because it really forces you to actually really edit and come up with something more concise than you would probably have written previously. I think it's great that it carries on letting you write past 140 and just, you know, says -6, -7, so you can actually think what you want to write and then go back and say, right, okay, this isn't that clear. I could say this in a shorter way. I can't be the only person who spends a lot of time trying to make it shorter and shorter.
Yeah, I think that, you know, some people say that, you know, it's killed writing or killed blogging or whatever, but I do find the same thing, that I'll end up saying a lot of weasel words or things that don't really, you know, cutting it down to what am I trying to actually say, and writing kind of as a headline versus, you know, how I feel today kind of post thing or whatever.
Yeah, it really encourages you to get to the point.
It's probably good timing that we're wrapping up, because your microphone just started sounding crazy.
I've got anything to plug. Covered everything I've been involved
with. I think he said I sense a disturbance in the force. All right, thank you, Damien, for a great conversation. I love talking about Link to SQL Entity Framework, and even the typography was interesting. So tune in next time for Herding Code.